Oh, I don't know if I can reach this mic. I'm Katie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
All right. Welcome to the Thursday night speaker meeting of the 38th Atlanta Roundup. Please help me open this meeting with a moment of silent meditation followed by the serenity prayer. Serenity prayer. And tonight I have asked Yona to read AA's 12 steps, and I've asked Heather to read the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous in that order.
I'm Yona, I'm an alcoholic.
Yona.
And these are the 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. Were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Hey everybody, I'm Heather. I'm an alcoholic.
Heather.
And these are the 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each AA group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, reminding us to place principles before personalities.
All right, thank you, Yona and Heather. All right, so tonight's speaker comes all the way from Roswell. And I had the pleasure of meeting and having coffee with Jennifer on Wednesday, and I was totally blown away by her transparency. I mean, it was the first time she and I had met each other, and I mean, she was just right out of the gate, just transparent, and just, you know, she does this deal. And the only thing she asked me to do for her, you know, for hosting her was keep her away from the cookies on the 19th floor. And like a good alcoholic, when I went to drop off my cookies, here she comes sneaking in like, I know she's not here yet, and there I was. And my ego would love to tell you that I kept her from eating cookies, but she, like anyone over the age of 5, is bigger than me, so I lost. So I owe you an amends, Jennifer. I apologize. I fell short in my responsibility. And with that, I give you guys Jennifer.
I'm gonna get all my liquids. One moment. everybody. I'm Jennifer. I'm a very grateful alcoholic.
That is so funny. So I was with Tom, and I was like, all right, I've got this host. And then I told her that she had to keep me from the cookies, but she has no idea what she is in for. So I was like, let's go get the cookies before she gets there. And I swear to God, y'all, I opened the door, and she's like, I'm going to need you to leave. Like, she's standing right there. I could not believe it. I was like, oh, my gosh, she's up in the cookie room. It was like 5 o'clock. Who is in the cookie room at 5 o'clock? There she was, doing her deal. Okay, I'm nervous. I'm so nervous. The goal is to not puke. That's the goal. I wish I had a higher goal than that. But first of all, I want to start by saying thank you so much to the committee for asking me to do this. I know why they asked me. I have a quite an impressive resume. I am actually the alternate Thursday night speaker for the Albany prepaid roundup. It was the state convention. Excuse me. Was it Albany? It might have been Albany. And the Thursday night speaker was actually a gentleman who was blind, and I was trying to convince him to take him just to another meeting so I could just be the speaker that night. That's just terribly rude, I know, but that's my humility. And then the Saturday night speaker got sick, and I thought for sure that I was in, right? But no, they had an alternate Saturday night. I was truly the alternate Thursday night speaker for that, so I didn't get to speak. I have to say, I have been coming. My first roundup was when I was 19 years old, and I remember sitting in the back of the room thinking, I seriously need to be the speaker at that roundup. And I had absolutely no idea what the heck I was talking about, and so now I am, and I'm thinking when they called, I was like, do you have the right number? So I am so grateful and so, so humbled by this. I truly am, and I thank you, all of you, for asking me to do this. So for those of you that have heard me tell my story before, I've had a lot of different experiences with speaking, but the one that stands out the most is one time at Clarkston. One of the first times I ever spoke, I was quite sure I was going to teach everybody how to stay sober, so I got up to speak and to share all of my wisdom, and right about 15 minutes into it, it was, you know, that talk that you give, that awful talk that you give. I couldn't do it anymore. I just stepped away from the podium, and I walked straight into room 10 at Clarkston, and my sponsor followed me in there. I thought for sure to share with me that God had spoken through me and that all was well. And that is not what she said. She said, it was exactly as bad as you thought it was. So she gave me a little direction, which I hopefully will follow tonight, and what I've tried to follow ever since, and that's that she said, before you speak, first she said, you will not cuss. I hopefully haven't already broken that rule. So not to cuss, to give my sobriety date, which is July 6, 1987, to say the third step prayer before I speak, and to read something from the big book so I can let God take over. So I'm going to do that very quickly, and then we'll get started. So I'll read from the third step because it really does describe me quite well. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of the selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It did not work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch. Did I say that word right? Arch through which we passed to freedom. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, As we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or hereafter. We were reborn. Thank you. As I said, I got sober on July 6, 1987, and on that day I showed up at Decatur Hospital with a bag of very large bag of inappropriate clothes, and I voluntarily checked myself into treatment. And the person that showed up at that hospital was very far from the person, I thank God, that stands here today. I remember standing there. I couldn't believe I'd gotten to that place. I remember I had come to a place where I couldn't even look at myself in the mirror. It hurt to look at myself in the mirror. I would literally, my eyes would burn if I caught a glimpse of my own self in the mirror. And I remember trying not to cry because I thought if I cried, they would think I wasn't an alcoholic. I was terrified that they would think I wasn't an alcoholic, that they would find out what was really wrong with me was that I was a horrible, terrible, awful person. The best I could hope for was that they would believe I was an alcoholic. So I went upstairs, I remember sitting on the side of the bed, and I looked out the window. Decatur Hospital, there was this big curve, there was this white bag that was floating out in the street, and a car would hit it, and it would go back, and then it would float back out in the street. I remember sitting there thinking, I can't believe it's come to this. What's happened to me? Knowing that my life was over at that point, and knowing that from that day forward, it was going to be like a nightmare, that it was going to be like a big party was happening down the street, and I was grounded, and I wasn't going to be able to go to it. But knowing that that was going to be better than what I was living at that point, I was willing to live like that because I couldn't live the way I was living anymore. I felt so filthy and filthy dirty on the inside. I just didn't feel like there was any way to get cleaned up. I don't know any other way to describe that filth. And I remember when I went to my first AA meeting, it didn't feel like home. The women were so clean, I felt even more ashamed. I was terrified. I was afraid for about my first year of sobriety. Mostly I was afraid that I wasn't going to be able to do this. But the nurse came upstairs and asked me a few questions, and it was just a matter of seconds before she was not concerned if I was an alcoholic or not. That was a very quick diagnosis. I lied, of course, right away. She asked me a lot of questions that I felt were none of her business, like how often I drank or things like that. I didn't want to, alarm my parents or anything. I didn't feel it was necessary for me to go to detox. They were very intrusive questions. But I voluntarily checked into treatment, but of course lied about a number of things. That's where it all started for me. How I got there, I hopefully won't spend a ton of time on that. It's important to say I was 18 years old when I came to treatment. It's important to say that because, well, for a number of reasons. The longer I stay sober, the more I get the same response whenever I pick up a chip. I get, were you 12 when you got sober? I get that a lot. I was done. It was over. I heard a song today when I was driving to work, and it said that she'll ride this ride as far as it will go, and that's exactly what I did. I rode the ride as far as it would go. I rode it straight into the ground. There was not another bit of alcohol. There's a bug up here. I'm not having hallucinations. There's a bug floating around. I know this is not the place to say this, but it's really important for me to say this. I had a drinking problem. I drank too much. I really literally drank too much. I could not stop drinking, and I didn't even really like to do that. But I couldn't stop doing it. I would start drinking, and I couldn't quit drinking. I would drink 18 or 19 or 20 drinks at a time, and I couldn't stop doing that. And that's how I drank. I would drink really, really fast and large quantities, and there was no stopping me, and there was no I've heard it described before that I would wake up on one side of the gutter and that's what it was like to just be in my skin. And this, in the middle of the road, was what it felt like to be sort of nicely intoxicated. And on this side of the gutter was what it felt like to overshoot. And what it was like to be me was to jump up on this side of the gutter and sprint across the road and land on this side of the gutter. There was no standing in the middle of the road, and that's how it was every single time that I drank. It was just a sprint across the road, slamming into the other side of the gutter. I just had a drinking problem. And I wanted to slow it down. I really intended to slow it down. I tried everything. I tried drinking out of a straw. I tried... I put the straw in the pitcher of beer. I thought that I should have known that it was a problem. My first drunk was a bottle of cold duck and half a bottle of Southern Comfort with Fanta orange drink, and then a variety of other disgusting drinks. And I came home, I sort of bounced up the stairs. I was 12 years old, and I sort of bounced up the stairs, and my mom said, "How was the movie?" And I said, "Drinking." That was my response. And I said... I said, "I haven't been drinking." And then my mom said, "Oh, my God, someone's poisoned my baby." And so off to the hospital we went. And they said, "Your daughter's been drinking." And my mom said, "No, someone's poisoned her." And I threw up everywhere. And then they took me home, and I threw up in my bed and put my face in it. And I was sick as a dog for about a week after that. And what I remember coming to the next day, thinking, I will never, ever, 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 ever drink cold duck again. And I never did drink cold duck again. And I don't believe I drank Southern Comfort either, or Fanta Orange for that matter. That's how I drank. And but something else was wrong with me. And that's that I didn't fit. I didn't fit inside my skin. I didn't fit at school. I didn't fit anywhere. And I hated myself, and therefore I hated you. And I didn't, and there was something else that was wrong with me, and it seemed that everybody else knew that, and I couldn't blend. So everywhere I went, either they knew it and they would make fun of me, or I had to figure out how to intimidate them before they could. So school was a terrible place for me. I think the worst place I ever experienced was the lunchroom, and it was a horrible, horrible place. Everything about that was the place where I felt the most exposed. So I did everything I could to not be in there. My family was also very chaotic. My sister was an elite athlete, and so we moved around a lot to support her her gifts. And so we became very dysfunctional as a family around that. A lot of fighting, a lot of craziness, a lot of different athletes in my home. And that's important because there were a lot of really high achievers in my home all the time. And I mean, world-class Olympic athletes from all across the country, from all across the world, the best in the world. And then there was me, who I literally could barely tie my shoes. I am still one of the most uncoordinated human beings you will ever meet. And everything just didn't fit for me. And I was angry, and I hated very deeply. I just hated people, and I hated myself. So all of this together was who I was. So alcohol wasn't my only problem. As a matter of fact, alcohol was my solution. It was a lubricant between me and you. And it stopped working very quickly. It's also, I want to say that it's important. I also quit learning in school. It became really important to me to get out of school as quickly as I could. So as a result, I had about a seventh grade education. I kept getting kicked out of schools. My poor father would take me from school to school to school. As I got kicked out, he would find another one for me to go to, and they would ask me to leave, or we would move. And I was very, very far behind in school. When I got sober, I hadn't even read a piece of literature. I couldn't multiply or divide. I was very, very ignorant. And but that didn't matter to me, because I was going to marry a rich old man with a bad heart. So what was the that really did not make much of a difference to me. So things just progressed, and I became very, very, very vindictive in my family, and I want to just speed it up to where I got sober. I started to lie a lot. I stole a lot of things, and I started to run away from home often and intentionally tried to hurt my parents and my siblings. One day was in an argument with my boyfriend, and I say this because this is the person I became. I was in an argument with my boyfriend, and I just wanted the argument to stop. Simply wanted to get out of the argument. And so in order to do that, I told him that I had been raped by my sister's fiancé. I had not been raped by my sister's fiancé. I had slept with him, but I had not been raped by him. So he, of course, felt like that was a pretty serious situation, and so he decided that he was going to tell my parents, but I said, no, I'll tell him. So I just walked into my house and told my family this, and made my mother choose. I said, you've always chosen her, so you need to choose now. Who's it going to be, me or her? And she chose me. And as a result of that, nobody went to my sister's wedding. Nobody went to see my sister's first child be born. And I felt like that was what was the way it was supposed to be. One of the times that I ran away, things had gotten very chaotic in my family, and my mother had become very sick. And I called home, and my father told me that my mom had tried to commit suicide, and I just hung up the phone. And I wouldn't leave where I was, because if I left where I was going to leave what was there, all of the things that we were using. And I couldn't do that. I couldn't leave the alcohol. I couldn't leave. I just couldn't stop using. And I didn't know if my mother was alive or dead. And that's the person I became. So I finally convinced everyone to pile into the car just to drive by the hospital to see if he was lying to me or not. And the car was there, and they were there. So I didn't know if she was dead or alive. I knew that they were really there, but I didn't go in. And that's the person that I became. And so the next day when I went to go see her, she had these dark circles under her eyes. She looked awful. And I remember her saying to me, what have you become? Like, who are you? And I just looked her right in the eyes and I said, I'm who you made me to be. This is your fault. And she had bought me a puppy so I would quit running away. And I was drunk in my room one night and up writing really bad poetry. And the puppy just wanted out of the room, and it kept scratching at the door to try to leave. And I wouldn't let it out. And it finally got up on my chest and pooped right on my chest. And and I picked it up and threw it across the room. And that's the person that I was. That's who I was. And that's what showed up for treatment on July 6, 1987. And so it's not just alcohol that was my problem. And that's who I was afraid you were going to find out that I had become. And ignorant and angry and hateful and abusive and full of lies. So there was a lot to be done. So I showed up for treatment, and they agreed there was a lot of work to do. So for the first, I guess, 2 months, a month or so of treatment, I was in rape support groups. I lied all the way through that part of that process. And but I went to my first few meetings, and I met, they talked about sponsorship, and I remember thinking, well, it is about damn time, because my sister had sponsors and they gave money to her. So I was like, it's about time to get me a sponsor for this deal here. And so I found the best looking man I could find that looked like he had some money, and I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said yes. And he said, as long as you do whatever I tell you to do. And I said, of course. You know, I've been down that road before. And he said, all right, so you need to meet me here on Friday night. The Candler Street group was my first home group, and Mike B was my first sponsor. And he said, you will meet me here and do what I tell you to do. I said, all right. And so I met him down there on Friday night, and he said, okay, remember how I told you how to do whatever I said? And I said, well, like right now. I mean, right here? And he said, yes. So he turned me around and he said, this is Darlene and she's your sponsor. And Darlene had, she had the most beautiful smile I have ever seen in my life. And I would have gone to the ends of the earth to have what that woman had. And except for her hair. She had a horrible... She needed conditioning treatment, as most of the women needed conditioning treatments. But I say that every time, and it's still so damn funny, but it's true. She did. I love her. I did. She was so beautiful, way deep on the inside, and that was it. That's all it took. I wanted what she had, and I don't know what happened to me. And I was in a meeting today, and I said, I was so scared of coming and talking today, and I said, how in the world am I going to tell the story of what happened that first year? Like, how do you describe that miracle of that willingness? I mean, how do you tell the story of going from that person to Darlene so sweetly smiling at me and said, here's what I'm going to need from you, sweetheart. I'm going to need, if I ask you to stand on your head and spit quarters out of your butt on Peachtree Street, I'm going to need for you to do that. And me saying, all right. I had this experience of Will and Grace, not the TV show, it wasn't out yet, but that experience of Will and Grace just coming together in the most beautiful way, and it has locked in and it's never pulled apart. And I am so grateful. I don't know how that happened. I cannot tell you what happened to me. I picked up my chip this past Tuesday, and for those of you that have picked up your chips over for many years, you know what I mean. It gets awkward after a while. You know, when people clap and you're just like, you don't really know what to say because it's such a gift. And but I think I finally have figured out, I think, what it is that I celebrate on when I pick up a chip. It's July 6, 1987. It's not 26 years. It's July 6, 1987. That day happened is an absolute miracle. Everything else after that is what the promises are about. It's that this program works. It works. It works. If we do what was suggested, it will work. I can't tell you how it works. I can't give you the exact formula because it really is. It's about the level of willingness that I was challenged to, but it works. But I can't tell you why July 6, 1987 happened, and I'm so grateful for it, and it is such a miracle, because something was really, really wrong on July 5th and all those days before, and I had no idea. I couldn't see the truth, and then that insanity was just cut. So that's what Darlene told me. She said that she needed me to do that, and so at Decatur Hospital, they had this thing where you got this tiny little camel for a pin. It was about that big if you did your four-step. And I wanted that damn pin. It was about that big, and I wanted it. And that's why I did my four-step pin, not for any spiritual reasons at all. Well, and then they all clapped for you, and you got to do the, you got your community meeting, and so I wanted that too, of course. That's why I picked up my white chip, too, because everybody was clapping. I was like, what are they clapping for? I want that. So they clapped for me, and I got my white chip. So I sort of followed my ego through the first couple of things that happened, I guess. So anyways, I did my first four-step in treatment, 30 days. Thank God for that. Because that's where I said, that's where I told the truth, the whole truth. I told the truth that I hadn't been raped. I told the truth about everything that I could. For the first time. And I did what Darlene told me. She said, I lie so much I don't know what's true. I remember I had like, I don't know, 7 or 8 months or maybe 6 years, I have no idea. And I was still telling people I'd lived in Colorado. I did not live in Colorado. I changed planes in Colorado one time. I'd never lived in Colorado. But I'd been saying it for so long, I had no idea it was true or not. And so what Darlene told me was, she said, when your truth is revealed, tell it. And I mean, I lied so much that I had no idea. And I still, lying to me just pops right out of my mouth. And if anyone in this room has known me for very long, I have literally said to you, oh, I just lied to you. Because if I've talked to you for a long period of time, we will be in the middle of a conversation and I will tell you a lie and have to go, oh, I think I just lied. And I will have to correct myself. It's I do it all the time. So that's something that Darlene taught me. So that first four-step, I wrote all of it. I wrote the truth. And then I She gave me one of the best gifts. I've heard a lot of people talk about their fifth steps, and I've heard them say that their sponsor, when they did their fifth step with their sponsor was like, "Oh, is that it? That all you got? You know, bring it. I got better." You know, and they've fallen asleep in their fifth steps, and they've, you know, been like, "That is nothing. I did worse than that." That is not what Darlene did. Darlene did not do that. She went, "Wow, that's probably not the person you want to be, is it?" You know. She really did validate that those were not the things that that people do when they want to be a part of other people's lives. She acknowledged that these were hurtful things. She acknowledged that I certainly had been under the influence of some pretty strong dishonesty. And she said, "You're very fortunate because we have a lot of other steps that are going to help a lot with this. And you can change if you want to." And she taught me the true power of step five. And she didn't run out of the room screaming. She didn't send me into any kind of shame spiral. But she did say what I believe to be true, you know. I'm really grateful for that. So we were reading the steps. One of the things that I love to do when someone's reading the steps, if I can shut my mouth long enough while the meeting's going on, stop talking about, but if I actually listen, is I love when someone's reading the steps to just, each time a step is read, to let it kind of wash over me and remember the step that I've worked, you know, and let a memory of the step sort of hit me. And so when you was reading the steps, I thought about the first step, and I thought about sitting at Decatur Hospital with my bag of inappropriate clothes. That was my first step. But really, for me, I had absolutely no idea what alcoholism had done to me until I'd been sober for a while. I had no idea what I had lost as a result of this disease until I'd been sober for a while, because I didn't value myself enough to know what I had lost. I remember being in, I was in treatment for 2 years, because some of us are sicker than others, and I remember my therapist saying to me, right around, I don't know, 5 months or so, he said, "You are a prostitute, just not a very well-paid one." And that's nice, huh? True. It was true. And I had no idea. And I don't know what's worse, being a prostitute or not knowing you were one. You know? Had no idea. And having to have it pointed out that I had a disease that was so powerful that I didn't even value what I was doing enough to call it that. You know? Didn't even value myself enough to call it prostitution, you know. I didn't even have a price on it, and I just called it rapid dating. I just thought I was really intuitive, and I knew it wasn't going to work out quickly. And I took what was offered and left. So. And I didn't know that my education was going to be a huge part of my consequence. I didn't know that not learning in sixth grade was going to make it hard to know if that stupid word was arc or arch. I've read that word 5,000 times. You know, I graduated from Georgia State summa cum laude, and I still can't read that stupid word. You know, when I graduated from Georgia State summa cum laude, I had to ask them how to spell it. There's certain things that just can't be fixed, you know. There's certain things that you have to live with. But I'm kind of speeding ahead. I'm jumping all over the place here now. So I got out of Decatur Hospital and worked with Darlene. Went to a treatment center called. Doesn't matter where I went, but I went to another treatment center. And one of the big things that you weren't supposed to do at this treatment center was. Use, which I didn't do, but you were also not supposed to meet boys, which was a dumb rule, in my opinion. They said I had issues with men. And so while I was in the woods with this boy talking about those issues, he said to me, "I love you, Jennifer." And I said, "I love you, too." And I thought, what the hell is this guy's name? I could not remember his name. And we were doing something that I should have known his name to be doing it with him, and and it hit me, like, I should know his name. you know, and here I am doing the exact same thing I used to do, and I don't want to be this girl, you know. So went back to the halfway house, and somebody figured it out, and so they confronted me, and I lied, and they confronted me again, and I lied, because it wasn't their business, and they confronted me again, and I sort of told the truth, and then I told the truth, and then they kicked me out, which was, I could not believe it. I mean, they punished me for telling the truth. That was just unacceptable to me. I should have never told the truth. And so they kicked me out, and they said, they sent me to the homeless shelter. Well, they said, you can go home or you can go to the homeless shelter, and that was the third step. And when you were reading the steps, that's what I remember. I remember sitting at DAC with my back up against this big, giant tree. I could still feel the tree up against my back, and I remember, like, the wind blowing through me, and I remember my first third step. And saying, I have to go. I need to go to the homeless shelter. Now, I know my parents aren't going to let me go because I'm from Dunwoody, right? But I'll go, right? So I call my parents and I'm like, they want me to go to the homeless shelter. I'm like, we'll pick you up and we'll take you. They're thrilled. We'll get you there. So off I go to the homeless shelter. And what a great experience. So I get there, and when I get to the homeless shelter, there's no meetings at all. There's an evangelical preacher that comes in twice a day, and I'm the head cook at the homeless shelter. I work from 5 in the morning till 7 at night. I make $2 a week, and I am reading the Bible and a couple of romance novels a day because they're the little tiny ones, and I've never really read before, so I'm eating these things up, and I decide the combination of the Bible and the romance novels and a little bit of just coming off of some other chemicals, I decide that I'm Jesus' wife. Makes sense to me. A little psychotic. And all the other women are down with it. They just want me to give them their Cheerios for breakfast. Everything's good. And so a month into it, I call my sponsor to tell her, you know, who she's serving. And she's like, what is wrong with you, you know? And so she clears that up for me, and we get back to basics. And but it's good, because if you're Jesus' wife, you can't just go off into the woods with anybody, right? So it keeps me from, you know, sleeping with just anybody. And so finish up at the homeless shelter, and then I go back to treatment and stay there for a couple of years and continue to work the steps and continue to try to find my way back to who I was, and had absolutely no idea what that meant. But during that time, I stepped away from men, and I want to talk about that a little bit. The women of Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. There's no doubt about that. But the men of Alcoholics Anonymous also saved my life because they stayed away from me. And the ones that didn't have enough sense to stay away from me, the other men that had more sense kept them away from me. And I don't know that we talk about that enough anymore. And I just want to say thank you to the men that did that. And I want to remind the old timers that it's okay to continue to do that. It's okay to talk to the new men and to remind them that we need some space. The women need space. You know, we're here and we're so injured. You know, we just need some space. We need each other. And we need a little bit of space. And believe me, you want some space from us. You need a little bit of space from us. It was an important experience. And I was a member of the Clarkson 12-step group, and they gave me lots of space, and I'm grateful for that. My new sponsor was a woman named Laura, and I loved her very much. She also could have used a little bit of conditioning treatment, but she was an amazing woman. And I had this experience of doing another four-step. I also had some abuse stuff that happened that did actually really happen in my childhood. And again, I bring this up because I hear people talk about this, that you can't get sober if that happens, or you have to stay angry or bitter or in therapy for the rest of your life. And there was a period of time where I had to do a lot of work around that. But it is Alcoholics Anonymous it's in Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to learn to forgive the unforgivable. And today I have a relationship with that person, and I love him very much. And I'm very grateful for that. I'm grateful that I can be that person. I remember sitting with Gay G. I'd done this four-step on this stuff, and just written this four step, like, I hate, you know, just because it was, there was a lot. And it was page after page of just vile stuff coming out of me. And when I went to go tell Laura I was ready to do my fifth step, she said, no, you're going to do this one with Gay. And I was like, oh, my God, any of you know Gay? No, this Gay was an incredible woman. And I did not want to read this fifth step to her. And I'm so grateful I didn't know it was going to be her. So I went to her house. And again, when you were reading the steps, I was thinking of her sitting on her piano bench. And she taught me about step 6 and 7. And she said, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. Turns out she didn't make that up. That was actually in the 12 and 12, but I thought she was brilliant. And she said, you know, you can write about all this stuff. And you can forgive because it makes you uncomfortable to not forgive. Or you can even go deeper than that. And you can forgive because it's the right thing to do. Or you can go deeper than that. And she just kept taking me deeper and deeper and deeper with this stuff. And she really gave me step 6 and 7. And I'm so grateful for that time I got to spend with her and all the years I got to spend with Gay. And she passed away. And I feel so incredibly honored that any bit of her Gay is in my heart and Laura. She also died. That they're in me and what they taught me. I will never, ever be able to repay Alcoholics Anonymous for what those women gave me. Never. So I'm very, very grateful for them. I can also say that step 6 and 7 has been a huge part of my sobriety as I've grown later on too. And I'm going to start jumping around. I hope you guys can stay with me on this because my sobriety has been really through the eyes of the steps. I continue to grow with as a result of the steps. But around 17 years, I got to experience step 6 and 7 again at a very, very deep level, and I'm very grateful for that time as well. I got to see step 6 and 7 like steps 1, 2, and 3, where I really saw how powerless I am over a character defect. The character defect for me that's more. I want more. This one particular character defect is I want more. I want to be adored more. I want to be the prettiest, the best, the smartest. I want everything at a level that's just not due to me. And it really, I had no idea how much it could destroy my life and how it was still festering inside of me. And it was right around that time when I realized that I couldn't make it go away. I couldn't wish it away. And there were days when I literally was on my knees, on my bed, just beating my bed, screaming, you have to make this go away. You have to help me. I can't stop it, you know. And it wasn't that it got just removed. It was that he attended to me and loved me through it. And you attended to me and loved me through it. I would go to meetings. I remember being at a meeting at Galano, and this beautiful man that I've never seen before, never seen since, just looked at me and said, whatever it is you're doing, just don't do it. Like, he knew. He just knew. He's like, don't. Just don't do it. It's going to destroy you. You know, and people just come into me. There's a man in the back of the room back there that went to my... It was really tough. Badass guy that goes to my home group that came up to me and just said, I don't know what's happening to you, but it's a beautiful thing, and I can see how much you're hurting. People like that came up to me during that time and just loved me, you know, and that's what got me through that time. So these steps have saved my life in ways that had nothing really to do with just drinking. See, at that time, I had to make a decision. I knew if I chose to act out on this character defects, that there was a really good chance that I would drink. And for the first time in my sobriety, truly for the first time in my sobriety, I thought, well, maybe I'll risk it. And that's pretty dangerous. But then the second thought that I had after that was, but if I act out on these things, I might lose my relationship with God. And I thought, I will not risk that. And I don't know if I can really describe how important that is to me, but that was the first time in my life that I truly chose God over anything. And that was a turning point for me. I chose God over anything. And that's when I really believe that I stopped staying sober out of fear. And I started staying sober out of this. Just reaching for love instead of just the fear of what would happen to me if I drank. Not that staying sober out of fear is a bad thing. It was time for me to go to that next place. I don't ever want to lose that relationship with my higher power. Not the kind of God that loves me like that. Not that I can't ever sacrifice that love. That is too beautiful. It's too important to me. Step eight and nine have been really important. They've been and earlier in my sobriety, I had the opportunity to make amends to my sister for what I did to her. And I told her, Gay actually told me exactly what I would say. Step nine is about discipline. And I wasn't to go tell her I couldn't just tell her whatever I wanted to tell her. I had to tell her what Gay told me to say, and that's that it didn't happen. I'm not the sister that I want to be, and that I was wrong. And those were the exact words that I said to her, and she just looked at me, and she cocked her head to the side, and she opened her arms up, and she said, I love you. And I would have never guessed that step nine would have taught me so much about how good people are. Like, my sister, underneath all these years, right underneath my own nose, was one of the most loving people. And I had no idea. She did not have to... Thank you so much. I'm up here like snotting all over the place. She did not have to do that, you know. About 15 years later, she called me up one day and she goes, you know what, I'm seriously pissed off at you for that shit. And I was like, well, yeah, I would have been too. And she's like, seriously, like, that was wrong. And I was like, it was. And she's like, all right, good. Are we good? And I was like, we're good. And she's like, all right. She's incredible. I could tell you so many great stories about her, what she's up to now, but she's neat. So step eight, also, I wish I could also say that in my sobriety, I've just been really a great person, but that's not necessarily the case. There's a sponsee in the room here right now that I love very much, and she told me something one time, and I said, I don't really know what to do about that. Can I go talk to somebody about it? And she said, yeah, that's fine. You can go talk to her about it. And then she called me up about 15 minutes later, and she said, you know what, I'd prefer that you didn't do that. And I said, all right, that's fine. So about 20 minutes later, I called the person. She asked me not to do that, and I told her, because that's what a great sponsor I am. And not proud of that. And I realized what I did after I did it. And then I thought, I can't tell her, because that would hurt her. And then I thought, if I don't tell her this, I will never be able to live with myself. By the way, this is not one of the worst things I ever did, unfortunately. So I took her out to coffee, and I sat her down, and I told her what I did, and I just cried and cried, and I said, I can't believe I did this. But I did it. And she just was like, it's okay. You know, she said, I love you. It's all right. It's all right. And I was just like, no, it's not okay. I mean, this is a sacred relationship, and I violated your trust. And she just loved me and said, I mean, it's shitty, but it's okay, you know, and I love you. So step nine, over and over and over again, lets us get loved by other people. So about 6 months later, we were out again, and she told me something else, and she said, don't tell a soul about this. Like, seriously, don't tell anybody. I was like, oh, of course not. So I get in my car. I'm in my car like 12 seconds. I pick up the phone, and I'm like, I'm getting ready to call somebody. I'm like, no, I did this to somebody one time. I'm not supposed to do this again. Who was it? And I was like, oh, my God, it was her. And I like put the phone down, and I'm like, what's wrong with you? You know, thank God I didn't do it. But so I'm not a quick study. I'm not. But I, so was married, and I've dated two men in sobriety, and I've married them both. And so the first man I married was a really good guy, and then I met my second husband, and he was a better guy. No, he was not. That was awful. I did not just say that. He was. Well, he is, but you know what I mean. That was not good. I did not just. Can we erase that on the tape? Holy shit, that's on a tape. Damn it. I just swore like three times. I just messed everything up. All right. My first husband and I were good, really good roommates, and he was a very, very good man. He was a very, very kind man. And I had that character defect that I didn't know anything about, and I fell in love with another man. And that is not recommended in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did everything I could to try to make that stop, and it didn't. And so I tried to do it the best I could, the right way. I left him, and Steve and I started our relationship. And my sponsor told me at the time, she said, "You can do this, but there will be consequences. And if you're willing to live with the consequences, you can do whatever. You can do this." And I had no idea what she meant. And she has taught me how to live with those consequences, and there have been those consequences, and most of them have been fear. I've missed out on a lot of things out of fear, a lot of things. I've missed out on how beautiful our love was in the beginning because I kept thinking, oh, this can't be. It's terrible. It's a bad thing. I was wrong. I'm a terrible person. I missed out on a number of things, but it has been. But for every one of those consequences, I have grown, and we have grown. So the consequences weren't punishments, and so I've learned what consequences truly are. I wasn't punished by the consequences, I've just grown from them. And so I've had, as a result of that, I've developed a whole new relationship with them. And so fear, and she taught me that we give God crooked lines and he makes them straight. And our marriage has taught me that. And we've been together now for, I always mess this up, 18 years. And he loves me like I have never, ever been loved in my life. And the fact that God loves me enough to let him love me is says a whole lot about God. And I remember going to my sponsor after and doing the ninth step on my first marriage and saying, okay, how do I make this right? How do I make amends to Bob for what I did to him? And she said, this one you don't make amends. This one you can't make right. This one you live with. And that has been an amends that has been one of the hardest amends that I've ever had to make. But that amends has saved my marriage to Steve many times. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for her wisdom around that amends. And we've grown together, and he has been there for me. And I was also told that it's important to talk about the things that have happened and what I've become as a result of staying sober. And I've got a few more minutes to do that. So I went to school. I wish I could say I went back to school, but I was never in school to begin with. So I went to school, and I thought maybe that what was wrong was I was some sort of idiot savant or something. And so when I went to go get the test to go to college, they were going to go like, wow, what was wrong was you just weren't challenged as a young adult. And, you know, you see those movies and stuff, and you're just brilliant, and we need to put you in the fast track school. And that is not what happened at all. They were like... First, I got my my scripts or whatever. No, scripts are what you get for drugs. The Sanscripts? Transcripts. Sanscripts. The transcripts. And they were like, they said, do you realize that you have a seventh grade education? Like, you should not have even gotten out of seventh grade. There was nothing past seventh grade, essentially, that was worth a thing. And so, So I had to take 2 years of college that didn't even count. Well, first of all, I had to get like 45 measles shots. I don't know what the hell that was about, but they just kept giving me measles shots. It was unbelievable. They really, really making it hard to get into school. After all the measles shots, I went and 2 years of college, it didn't even count. And it, God, that was hard. I mean, just learning how to multiply and divide is not easy. I would just raise my hand and go, I'm sorry, when did we learn that? And the teacher would go, that was like sixth grade. And I was like, okay, got it. I'll just quiet, right? I remember asking one time, oh, never mind. I just asked some of the dumbest questions I asked. Did Shakespeare commission Tchaikovsky to write Romeo and Juliet? I mean, I asked stuff like that in the middle of class, you know. I thought that was a really well thought out question, but it was not. So finally, when I graduated from Georgia State summa cum laude, and I say that because that is a dang miracle. It is absolutely a miracle. And I got my bachelor's, and now I'm in graduate school, and I got an A in statistics the other day, and I got lost in the parking lot on the way out of the test. I could not find my way out of the parking lot. I kept ending up the same spot over and over again. I was like, this is ridiculous. I just got an A, and I can't find my way out of the parking lot. So, I have a career that I love. I have a career that I absolutely adore today. I get to be with the most heroic, courageous people every single day. I get to work with people that are passionate and love their job. Every day, the people I'm with love coming to work. Sometimes they show up and like they sort of even forget to put on half their wardrobe because they're so excited to come to work. It is the greatest place to work. And I've loved my job for 23 years. There's a person in the room who has been my mentor for all that time. He's here today. I've just got people that love me and have cared for me for so long that are here. There's somebody in the room today that has known me since high school and seen me and been a part of my family for that whole time. I'm so blessed with people that I love and that I care about. Today, the things that I was the furthest away from are the most important to me today. Truth and love and grace. The things that I knew nothing about have come into my life, all because of this program. We were talking, my fabulous cookie host and I, Katie, were talking about this last thing I want to close with, that right around that same time, around 17 years, I also had a really important kind of shift that... We talk a lot about how sick we were when we got here. And I think that's a fair assessment in a lot of ways. That girl saved my life. I don't know that I could do what she did. And I'm so grateful. I am so grateful to that little 18-year-old kid that showed up with that bag of inappropriate clothes and all that she did for me. The other thing that I think that I misunderstood about Alcoholics Anonymous is somewhere in our literature it talks about how it's circumstance and not virtue that got us here. And so for a long time what I thought that meant was that without Alcoholics Anonymous I'm nothing. You know, I remember saying for years, without AA I'm just a whore on the street. And that's not true. AA has given me my life. Without AA, I wouldn't be sober. I can't hear my disease without the 12 steps. I cannot hear it talking to me. I don't stand a chance without a power greater than myself because I am insane when it comes to alcohol. Without you guys, I think what I'm thinking about alcohol is totally normal. Without you guys, I think what I think about myself is totally normal. You know, I think what I think about other people is right without y'all. Without you guys, I'm in a really dangerous place. So you've brought me so much sanity. But I started to believe that there was nothing else inside of me, that I was nobody else. And in order to live with that, I had to actually start to tell a lie about who I was. And to live with a lie is a dangerous place for me in any kind of lie. Not just I will steal from you and lie, but any kind of lie is a dangerous thing for me. So that was the other thing that was happening for me at that kind of that spiritual dark place for me at around 17 years, where I had to come to terms with a really scary thing, which was there's a lot about me that's right also. There's a lot about me that's really good also, besides alcoholism and recovery from alcoholism. And that's hard to talk about because sometimes we call that ego. And I think there's another word for it besides ego. I haven't quite come up with that word yet. I have to. I have to say it out loud. I haven't quite figured out how to talk about it yet. But I think it's important for us to sort of find a place for it. So I want to close with something from... there's a picture of me and Laura and Hal in my big book. I'll just run open up to... Her hair looks really good in this picture. It really does. It does. Okay, I've talked a lot about hair tonight. That's kind of weird. Okay, this is from Rum, Radio, and Rebellion in the big book from the third edition. To the new men, I would like to also say that this program is not for sissies, for in my humble opinion, it takes a man to make the grade. It is not too difficult nor too easy to grasp. I have had many more reasons to drink since I've been in AA than I had in all of the years of my drinking. I've had many more problems, but thank God I've had the teachings of AA with which to face them. And believe me, I thank God that I found out about AA before I had to beat my brains out, before I'd been hospitalized, jailed, or lost a job. When I hear the more rugged stories of alcoholics who became sicker than I did with this affliction, I humbly thank God for showing me the handwriting on the wall. In meeting me casually, I don't think that my strong belief in the man upstairs shows, but I have no other explanation for the many good things that have happened to me since I've been in AA. They came to me from a greater power. These words may be difficult for you to understand now, but be patient and you will know what I mean. If I were asked what, in my opinion, was the most important factor to be successful in this program, besides following the 12 steps, I would say honesty. And the most important person to be honest with is yourself. If there is something in my story that rings a bell with you, then do something now. I repeat, I am one of the fortunate members of AA, a lucky guy who is very grateful. So I'm going to close with one last story, and it's about a woman who was the voice of AA, of the Roundup not long ago. Her name was Lindsay, and there's many of her children in here today. And when Lindsay was dying, she wore this necklace. She wore it all the time. And when she was dying, I was staying in her room, and I saw it, and I wanted to steal it. Because that's how I am. I wanted to steal it. I haven't told her children the story yet, so bear with me. I wanted to steal it because I thought if I stole this necklace and I wore it, well, I wouldn't tell anyone I stole it, but if I stole it, I had it, then everyone would know how important I was to Lindsay. And I loved Lindsay very much. A lot of people did. And I wanted that necklace because I wanted her close to me. And I thought, you cannot seriously steal a woman who's dying's necklace. That's really not very spiritual. So I put it down, picked it up, put it down, picked it up, and I was like, well, somebody else is going to get it. I want it. It was a St. Francis medallion, I think, right? So then I went to the hospital, and I kept kind of casually mentioning how weird it was to see the necklace not on Lindsay, and I just kept thinking maybe somebody will give it to me, right? Of course, everybody had a lot of other stuff going on. They weren't really concerned about me and the damn necklace, but I was trying to bring it up, and... But nobody did, and I was talking to Lindsay, and I asked her. I said, "How are you going to come to me, and when you pass?" And she just smiled, and I said, "I know you've got some stuff, but I'm just curious. Like, how's it going to be?" And she didn't answer me. And so, after she passed, I went back. I said, "I'd really like to go back to the house," and I don't know that we actually went back to the house, but I brought the necklace back up again because I'm hard headed, and I wanted someone to give me the necklace. But I didn't ask for it. I didn't ask at all for it. So anyways, I didn't get the necklace. I didn't steal it. I didn't get it. So a couple days later, Steve and I went to our home group for, it was the New Year's Eve dance. And this guy named Jose came up to me out of the blue, out of nowhere. And he had his hand clasped like this. He said, "I have to give you something." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I have to give this to you." And he opened up his hand, and he had a medallion in his hand, and it was the a medallion of the of a saint, and the saint, I cannot remember his name now, but he said, "I had to give this to you because he's slaying the dragon, and you've taught me about how to slay the dragon, and you have to have this." And I knew it was Lindsay, and I knew she was saying, "I saw you trying to steal my damn necklace." I knew it. How could it? It was 2 days later, right? I had told anybody. And I knew that, I also knew she was saying, "And I love you because you were trying to steal my necklace." Not in spite of, but because. And that's how Lindsay loved me. Because I was trying to steal her necklace. And that's how AA has loved me, and that's how you have loved me. Because I am the person that wants to steal your necklace, and because I don't steal your necklace. And I thank God for people like her and for you, and thank you so much for listening to me tonight.